All right, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. I'm recording this just after midnight on the 1st of February. We've just gone and done a Brexit, but more relevant to the Oasis Podcast is that we just had a mad 24 hours or so from Noel and Liam, which was a brand new song from Noel and video, and a brand new video from Liam, and a brand new kind of album. The acoustic sessions was released kind of out of nowhere. We had this sort of little mini trailer sort of video thing a few days ago. And then out of nowhere this morning, we get acoustic sessions album, effectively, 8 tracks. And this crazy video with Eric Cantona. So I absolutely loved it. Our review, both the Noel track and all the Liam stuff, on the next episode, because I'll be talking to a couple of people, hopefully, fingers crossed, Charlie Lightning, who's been on here before and who directed the video with Eric. So that would be fantastic. Hopefully that should happen next week. And I'll catch up with a couple of other people as well to have a bit of a discussion about them. But generally, I really enjoyed the Liam acoustic sessions, especially Sad Song. Great to have that finally, a really good version of that. Yeah, and some of the Why Me, Why Not songs with the production stripped away was really great to hear as well. But anyway, we'll go into that in more detail in the next one. And obviously we've got the Noel song as well, Blue Moon Rising, which, as I think I mentioned, like end of last year when it leaked, not a huge fan of. But anyway, we'll give it a few more listens and we'll do a proper review of all of this stuff very shortly. But today, the big focus is on Chris Elliott. Now, the reason Chris came to my attention was that he did the strings on Why Me, Why Not, other bits as well. And we dig into all of Liam's tracks that he worked on the album, which is really, really cool to go through and get that real insight from a proper musician, kind of breaking down exactly what he's doing and why in those songs. So I really hope you enjoy that. But beyond the Liam stuff as well, we get to hear about him working with Mark Ronson on Amy Winehouse and a bunch of other artists as well. So especially for all the sort of real music nerds out there listening to this like me, I hope you really enjoy this one. And if you do, please do let me know, drop me a message, maybe drop Chris a message as well. That'd be absolutely fantastic. All right, so without any further ado, let's cross over to me talking with Chris Elliott. So welcome to the Oasis Podcast. Chris Elliott, how are you doing?
Very well, James. Thank you. Good to be here.
Wonderful. It's an exciting day for you because obviously we're here to primarily talk about the bits you've done with Liam Gallagher, but it's a big day for you personally as a musician.
Yes, it is. My solo project, which goes out under Christopher Elliott, we've just released our first EP today. So.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I was giving it a bit of a listen, and I'm a big fan of Serge Gainsbourg, so I was very pleased to see, you know, you've referenced Serge Gainsbourg as well in that, which, and I've given it a bit of a listen today, and yeah, it's really lovely stuff. I mean, you know, a lot of very piano-y based and, you know, just great melodies intersecting. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot, James. Yeah, it's great to get it out finally, and I got a really nice video done for it as well by a guy in Paris, actually. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. And what's the plan for it? I know, is it
you know, I know a lot of people when they're recording instrumental stuff these days with, you know, the industry as it is, there's often the idea of like, well, can it then be used in TV shows or used in other things like that? Or is this, no, this is a my vision and as an artist to be out to demonstrate what you are kind of thing?
That is exactly what it is. It's, you know, I've worked in the shadows, if you like, of the music industry for many years, and I've always wanted to do my own project. And I think the combination of technology prices coming down, so I could just basically get my own kit at home. I live in a converted chapel with a really nice piano in the back room, which is very high. And so I thought, I've got to record it in there if I can. And I was able to do that a couple of years ago. I started doing it, and very sort of fortuitously, a record company that I was working with at the time, Network Records, asked me if I was working on a solo project. And then I sent a few demos, and that was it. And so far, we've released a couple of singles and this EP today, and the album is due to come out properly in the spring.
I thought it was quite interesting. I was talking last week about Andy Bell from Ride and briefly of Oasis. Well, not briefly, he was in it for about 10 years. But he did an album like of electronic sort of music earlier this year under the name Glock. And I was talking in the last episode about how, you know, I really enjoyed it as an album to just have on in the background while I was doing other things, was working or concentrating on other things. And I thought, well, hold on, is that quite insulting, you know, because if you've crafted this thing, and I'm similar with you this instrumental music that's really beautiful, and I do sort of think, oh, well, this would be good, something to listen to while I'm at work or while I'm doing, you know, other things. Is that insulting to you? Would you think, no, you have to sit down and listen to this and actually like pay attention to it?
It's interesting that you say that, because you know, now the music business has basically reinvented itself in a couple of different ways, and one of those is what happens with streaming. I use Spotify, and I know that my daughter, for example, when she was studying for her A-levels a few years ago, she would just put on a playlist that would play music for concentration or music for studying or something, and she heard me playing some of my pieces, and she said, oh, that would go well on that playlist, you know, or this playlist. And I started to realize what was actually going on was that the desire for instrumental music right now is quite high because of that very reason, because people will subscribe to these playlists. And to be honest, as long as the music's getting out there, I'm totally okay with it, and I'm not precious about it. It was really amazing today to actually push the release button, you know, onto Instagram to let people know that the music's out there, and see it go live and the video. And yeah, it's just incredible what's happened in the music business. So I think, yeah, worrying about whether or not it's background music or not is not really the point. It's just amazing to have your music out there.
Yeah, fantastic. That's brilliant. That's great. Well, let's take it back a little bit. Obviously, we'll get to the Liam stuff, but I just wanted to, what I love about these interviews is that, you know, all these, the different people that we speak to, you know, it's the journey that then finds them to at some point dealing with a Gallagher brother, basically in whatever context. And just tell me about your, like, where did you grow up? Were you part of a big family? Was music a big part of your life?
I grew up in Whitstable. I think that was a good place to grow up because a lot of people were very into music. The whole kind of Canterbury scene had happened in the early 70s while I was, you know, a very small boy, and my father was a very keen classical pianist, and he got me playing the piano when I was very young. I think it was four. I think I might have even learned what middle C was before a letter of the alphabet.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I grew up in a house where, yeah, he played the piano a lot and was quite involved in music.
I was being ushered along the kind of classical route, doing exams and even
competitions sometimes. It would be a situation where we both have to enter this music festival competition thing that happened in Canterbury. My dad would be in the adult class, obviously, playing some kind of concerto or something, and I'd be doing, you know, one of my grade pieces or something like that. Mm. This always occurred on either the first or second Saturday in May, which happened to be, in those days, FA Cup final day.
All right.
All my mates would be wearing their football kits, probably playing football in the morning, and, you know, I'd be having to sort of dress up a bit to go and do this thing, you know, which I hated. Years later, by complete coincidence, I met a girl who said that she'd remembered me from one of these things, this competition. And she did remind me that I played the piano in my Chelsea football kit and I had muddy knees.
That's rock and roll, man.
Music was always very much a big thing in my life when I was younger. It was something I was, you know, I was good at it. I wasn't particularly good at anything else, to be honest. My dad wanted me to go to music college, probably because he didn't get the opportunity to go himself. And so I had to learn a second instrument, and this was sort of decided for me, and it was the violin. I think I was aged 8, and basically that was the beginning of 5 years of torture for me, because I really didn't get on with it. My teachers would always be trying to bend my left arm round more, which always felt like it was going to break. And on one of the occasions when my father and I went to get some music for my next grade, you know, piano grade or violin grade, we went into this shop in Canterbury, which anyone down there would probably remember. It was called Kennard's, and it had a classical music section. And unbeknown to me, through a side entrance on a different street, was the rock and roll emporium that was Kennard's music. And my dad was chatting away with the owner of the shop, the classical part, and I think I sort of disappeared off and looked behind a curtain, and I saw in front of me a platform covered in electric guitars, lit with stage lighting. And I went in there and I touched a Gibson guitar and felt how heavy it was. You know, I was only about 12. I felt this thing, it felt incredible, the quality of it and the look of it, and everything there just changed my life, I think. And subsequently managed to persuade my dad to let me finish the violin, give that up, and start learning guitar. You know, I said, I want an electric guitar, Dad, please. And he thought about it and eventually came back and said, I'll get you an electric guitar for your birthday, but you have to promise me to have lessons in classical guitar as well. Mm-hmm. So that sort of led me into a world of, you know, I met some new friends who had older brothers who were in bands, and I got taught my first couple of guitar chords, and then a different musical journey began for me, which was basically, although I was having classical guitar lessons, I learned all my kind of rock and roll stuff just by ear. I just worked out what the chords were.
Right.
I kind of went through my teens playing guitar like that in bands in Whitstable and Canterbury area, and then having the classical side develop as well. And my mind was very much on going to music college. I had an amazing music teacher, piano teacher by this time, who kind of saved me. His name was Morris Memmott, an amazing pianist and violinist. Mm. And although he was teaching me classical, it was obvious he was a rocker. As a student, he said he used to go to hear Rite of Spring and a Headbang. And he had his own band called Gizmo, who were like prog.
Right.
I went to one of their gigs, and they basically did Mars from the Planet Suite, but for like a full prog rock setup. And it was a fairly mind-blowing experience. The next significant thing to happen was I got involved in a kind of industrial electronic music project with a friend of mine, Gary Levermore, and his mate, Ian Williams. And that was a sort of different chapter for me. I was sort of playing keyboards and piano, and I got to help them record a couple of albums.
What year are we talking now?
This is 1985.
Right.
So I would have been about 19. And the band was called Bushido, which is the Japanese word for the code of the samurai.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, I didn't really know what I was doing. Gary was very well listened and started a record company called Third Mind Records. And it had a lot of industrial electronic kind of acts on there. And he used to create these cassette compilations of music which he liked and thought I should hear. You know, I mean, all kinds of stuff. And that kind of influenced the sort of writing I was doing. We sort of mixed that into my kind of classical piano style as well, I suppose. And then I got to the point where I realized that I wanted to go to college and study music properly. Well, not properly, but I just wanted to have that experience of a bit of freedom to do a few things. And I went there to basically study piano and maybe composition. And my wonderful piano teacher, Morris, he said, just forget about the Royal Academy, the Royal College. It'll be a struggle for you. And it was brilliant advice. He said, if I was you, I'd go to Dartington. And Dartington is a college of arts at the time down in Devon near Totnes, an absolutely beautiful arts utopia. And I went for an audition down there and got a place and started like the following September. And that was like 3 years of bliss for me. I quickly swapped to composition. I kept up classical piano. I played guitar in a few bands. But it was being in that kind of amazing environment, which is what it was. If anyone knows the place, they'd know what I mean. It was a 14th century manor on a hill right by the River Dart. And they had three art disciplines, music, theatre and visual arts. And that was it. And I think there were 300 students in total. So a lot of people found it very isolated down there, especially if they'd come from big cities. But I absolutely loved it. I'm really into kind of nature and wildlife, walking. So it was just brilliant. Things hadn't been incredibly easy for me up until that point. You know, I was always having to kind of like do certain kind of jobs and things like that to get by. And suddenly I was in this place where I was getting a grant and I could just be, you know, just immerse myself in the music. And there, in our first year, we covered 20th century music, and I was introduced to American minimalism, you know, people like Steve Reich, John Adams, Terry Riley, these kind of composers, as well as the kind of wholly minimalist types like Goretzky, Arvid Pärt, John Taverner. And that, yeah, was another big chapter, another moment for me, and I sort of started composing a bit like that, I suppose. And I got interested in film music as well. I used to love going to the cinema because of the beautiful sounding scores and all of that. And in my third year at college, I went to the London Film School, Covent Garden, for one day a week and did a kind of module of my degree there and wrote music for short films and things.
Fantastic.
And then kind of like moving back to London, you know, it was kind of a bit of a thing going from beautiful Devon to Stockwell. I have to say, it did take a little while for me to get used to that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Not that Stockwell's not a great place, it's an amazing place, but that was like 1992, and gentrification really hadn't quite happened there. It certainly hadn't happened there. It was beginning to happen maybe in Clapham. You know, I had my sights set firmly on trying to get into composing, writing music for films was my ultimate goal at that point. I was really lucky. I met a few people, particularly a guy called Richard Kirstein, who went on to get a job with Zomba Music, up in Willesden, and he signed me to the publishing label, and that opened a lot of doors, I suppose. And that being a sort of hardcore record company, the opportunities I got there were more to do with arranging for bands starting to do that.
Right, okay.
And that's where I suppose it all sort of began to happen. At the same time, though, I mean, I was doing little jingles and things like that, like everybody does.
Mm.
You know, my mantra at the time was just don't say no, just say yes to everything.
Mm.
Because everything was about, everything was and is about contacts and about who you meet.
Sure.
So I got into doing quite a lot of television stuff as well, like documentaries, historical documentaries, with one company in particular, Transworld International. And they were actually a sports production company. I think they're the biggest sports production company in the world.
Transworld Sports, right?
Exactly, that was like, exactly.
Saturday, yeah. Sunday morning. Yeah, Channel
exactly.
4, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
In fact, the guy who gave me the job, my first job, was is a guy called Stuart Binns, who's a brilliant broadcaster, brilliant TV producer, rather. And he actually invented Transworld Sport. He came up with the format. And Stuart had a passion for history. And a very sort of long story short, a guy called Adrian Wood, who was an archivist, a film archivist at the BBC, had been with the BBC for 30 years, basically worked out he knew where enough colour footage was around the world in all the archives to make the Second World War in colour. And he shot the idea of this to the BBC, and they rejected it and said, no one's going to be interested in the Second World War. This is like in about 92. And Adrian went off to see Transworld International, and there was Stuart, and that was it. We made the Second World War in colour, the first documentary series of that kind to be exclusively in colour. No colourised footage, all original. And I got to score it.
Wow.
And we realised that because of the kind of nature of the archive being sort of rather disparate shots that didn't necessarily all link well together, the only thread that could be constant would be the music. And so the music almost has a perpetual sort of drone going through it. And low, you know, like low-end strings, not heavy, but just an ominous sort of drone. So, yeah, that was an amazing experience for me to get to do that. America and did the American version of that over at PBS in Seattle. We did it in Japan. That was amazing, going to Japan, because the Japanese were pretty reluctant to let anyone else tell their history. Anyway, that's all one thing. And the other side of my career was developing at the time, and that was obviously in the music business.
That's fantastic. I say that's absolutely brilliant. And you mentioned about sort of starting to work with bands there as well. So when, so what sort of bands are you talking? Is this now into sort of the 90s now?
I guess sort of mid 90s. I can't remember like the first sort of proper artist that I worked for. It was quite hard to break into it. There was one early experience I had, which is quite interesting. I'd managed to blag a bit of studio time in Battery Studios, which my publisher, Zomba, owned. And Battery used to be Morgan Studios, which is a kind of very famous late 60s, early 70s studio. So I was working away on some TV score or pitch in what was called the programming room, which is like the smallest little studio. And I was blasting out the music I'd been working on when a girl appeared at the door. And she was the singer of in a band who were recording along the corridor in Studio 2. Then a guy appeared, and they asked me what it was I was working on. it was quite fast and dramatic strings, a bit sort of almost spaghetti western like, I suppose.
Right.
They were a band called Life's Addiction, and they were signed to London Records. And they asked me if I'd be interested in doing some string arrangements on the album, and of course I was. They set up a meeting with Phil Howells, the A&R guy at London Records, and we discussed the size of string section, amongst other things. In fact, I'd done a load of demos. I'd done demos on like 4 or 5 songs by this point, which they really liked. And the songs are really, really good. It was kind of post-trip hop. And I was really interested in film scoring and that sound, that more sort of, not symphonic, but cinematic orchestral sound. And I worked really hard to try and understand how it worked and how you'd achieve that. You're not going to achieve that with like 12 people. You need a lot of people to do that. Anyway, yeah, I was listening to bands like Massive Attack and Portishead, you know, Unfinished Sympathy and Dummy, which had that sound, that had that big low end to it.
Mm.
That was what I did for Life's Addiction. And we had a great time recording this in the James Bond studio.
Yeah.
And so I was explaining to Phil and the band that basically we would need quite a lot of people to achieve this sound. And I think they agreed to 36 people, which is pretty decent size.
Wow.
Including basses. We also had like a proper orchestral brass section for some big brass parts. We also had timpani as well. And we went to CTS in Wembley and did this recording session there. Unfortunately, though, the band split up before they could release the record.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I think they'd had a relationship that hadn't ended well.
Oh, no.
Unfortunately, the record, you know, it was never released. Maybe I don't really understand the complete story, or maybe I've never been told. But they were great. And the singer, Alison David, was absolutely amazing. She was like a kind of a new Shirley Bassey.
Right.
But with all that edge as well, and attitude of a proper rock and roll kind of person. And you can listen to it. It's on Spotify and YouTube. It's all there. It's well worth checking out because it's like a secret hidden album that no one really knows about. And I think I did like songs like Lightning Strikes, Ocean, Inner Shade.
Yeah.
And Alison had this kind of incredible bluesy type voice, which, you know, she was very, very good. She still is a great singer down in Brighton somewhere. So there was that. And I sort of scrapped around getting gigs with little independents here and there, of which I've now realised they can be the hardest jobs to do, because usually they don't have much budget, which means you don't get many players. And perhaps for the sort of string arrangements I write or like to write, they need quite a few people to sound good. You'd always have people saying, oh, can't we just get, you know, a violinist and a cellist and track them up 20 times? And no, it doesn't work. It just simply doesn't work.
No.
strings are just like a choir, and that everybody has a slightly different vibrato, everybody's pitch is microscopically different, and it's the way they blend together all those pitches that make a beautiful warm string sound.
No, well, definitely, and I can hear that kind of in the Liam stuff, and the stuff that I've heard of yours is very cinematic and very filmic, and even in the even in the stuff you've done with Liam, like the big comment that I seem to have been getting from, you know, from reading up and what people have been talking about the album is very cinematic, especially with like Gone.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's saying, oh, it sounds like Tarantino, or it sounds like a Bond theme, or, you know, this could be a Bond theme and things like that. And it's, yeah, you can definitely hear that in there.
Yeah. I think going back to an earlier job that I had, which was with the fantastic girl band Sugar Babes, I arranged their song Stronger.
Oh, wow.
I love that song. I love the fact that the Sugar Babes were like a kind of girl band, because that's, you know, it was Spice Girls and it was boy bands and all that kind of stuff, really, which I think of slightly negatively. But Sugar Babes were like the real thing. Those girls had real attitude. And that song, there was something about that song just got me. And it turned out that, just trying to remember how it happened. I think, again, it was a connection from being in Battery Studios and somebody simply hearing something I was working on, putting their head round the door, and that was Johnny Rockstar, who actually co-wrote Stronger with the producer Marius De Vries, who I had been working with for some time by then. Anyway, importantly, Stronger was mixed by Tom Elmhurst. And Tom, if you don't know, is one of the most successful mix engineers around. And it was through that connection with Tom that I got to work with Amy Winehouse on her second album.
Oh, Back in Black, like one of the greatest albums of the century.
Yeah, Back to Black. Yeah.
Just that one, yeah.
That happened because Darkus from Island Records, who was A&R-ing Amy, they were listening back to some of the mixes at Metropolis with Mark Ronson and Amy. And obviously Tom Elmhurst mixing. And I think Darkus was apparently said that he felt that some of the tracks needed something else on them. And I think Amy felt they were finished. And so
really?
Mark suggested, what about some strings? And apparently Amy said, I don't want any fucking strings on my record. And
really?
She was basically... thinking of the kind of strings that would have accompanied, you know, songs in the 80s and maybe early 90s.
Sure. Big slushy strings, yeah.
You know, high-end, glossy sort of strings. And Tom Elmhurst, mix engineer, he had been very complimentary to me during the mix of Stronger and said he really liked the fact that my strings were low and kind of atmospheric. And all of that came from the filmic thing. I realised with my work on the war films, it just needed to be low and atmospheric. I have a sense of foreboding, perhaps, whatever. And that came through predominantly a lower sound than high. I didn't know what I had to do. I just knew I was alone. People around me, but they didn't care. So I searched into my soul. And so that's obviously what went into Stronger. And Stronger was that kind of track. It was moody. And so Tom was very complimentary about that. And I think he said in that meeting in Metropolis, we should try Chris because he does stuff a little bit differently. The first thing I knew about it, I was in my studio. It was a Friday afternoon. I got a call from the A&R department of Island Records asking whether I'd be interested in writing string arrangements for the next Amy Winehouse album. Like, would I be interested?
Because she wasn't, after the first album, she wasn't like a massive superstar, but she was like, this is a really exciting new talent, wasn't it? That was sort of where she was at that point. And it's Back to Black and Rehab that then, you know, put her stratospheric. But at this point, she is just the coolest new artist around, right?
Yeah, I think that anyone who loves music, who heard the first album, Frank, would know, would just think this is going to be amazing. She's an incredible talent.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was really keen. They said, right, well, the session's booked for Monday, you know, and it was Friday. So not only do you get an incredible opportunity to work with someone like Amy Winehouse, but there's hardly any time to do a great job, you know. So I managed to negotiate it to Tuesday.
Wow.
They said, Mark can come and see you later this afternoon, and he just wants to go through the songs with you very quickly. They managed to send the songs over. I did a few sketches really quickly, just almost busking straight away. Luckily, you know, the songs weren't complicated in terms of harmony and chords and stuff.
And so can I just clarify the three songs here? They're three quite good songs. Rehab, Back to Black, and Love is a Losing Game.
That's it.
Is that correct?
That is it, yeah.
Well, that's, Chris, that's three of the best songs of the 21st century.
Well, and it's amazing, isn't it? The opportunity came that quickly and had to be done so fast, and I suppose maybe there's, you know, something to be said for spontaneity with all of this. So I was told that Mark, who I hadn't met, by the way, was going to be appearing at my studio later that afternoon. And I think the buzzer went about 4:30. He appeared. He had a guitar with him and a backpack. And I think he'd just flown in from Dublin, having done a DJ gig there, and he needed to go in half an hour to get to the airport to go to Edinburgh, because it was the summer, it was the festival, and he was going to be up there DJing again. I was really impressed that he was going to play guitar on his DJ set. I thought that was just superb.
And we
got on really well. He was quite naive about strings. You know, he hadn't done it before, really. And he was really excited about it. And unbeknown to me, he said to Amy, if you don't like the strings, I'll pay for them, so there's no problem.
Wow.
It's just a little experiment, you know, between us. I didn't know this, though. So I played him each sort of arrangement, the busk I'd done. He didn't want to add anything. He just wanted to remove notes here and there. But, you know, on the whole, he really liked what I did. And he said, all right, I've got to go. He said, one last thing, though. He said, Amy really hates the idea of doing strings. So can you think of something else that we could do in case, you know? And I was like pretty gobsmacked by that. And I said, oh, don't worry. We'll just keep it low and tremmy, i.e. tremolando, you know, spooky.
Okay.
I said, it'd be fine. And then I had another thought. And with the sessions I've been doing with Marius de Vries, like we'd just done Rufus Wainwright, and we would do our big string day in, say, Angel Studios or Abbey Road or somewhere, and we'd have the strings for maybe a couple of sessions in the day, and then in the evening we'd order a complete percussion fest to be brought in. We'd use one player, but we would have almost everything you could imagine in the room: timps, tubular bells, xylophone, vibes, great big grand cassa bass drum type thing, you know, everything. And then we would sort of improvise a percussion session from the string charts that we used earlier. So for this, I suddenly thought, oh, hang on, Mark, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll order a load of percussion, and we'll get Frank Ricotti, who is the absolute percussion master, to come and play at 6 o'clock on the day. And that way we can cover ourselves with something, at least, if the strings weren't accepted. And he was happy with that. On that session, we were in Metropolis, which is a really unusual place to record strings, because it's a very hard-standing room. And I think with strings, you either have a lovely big ambience, like in Abbey Road Studio One or Air Lyndhurst Hall, for kind of cinematic sound, or you have a kind of tight room for, say, you know, a really rhythmic rock and roll session. That's where we did Liam's stuff in Abbey Road Two for that very reason. So there wasn't loads of spill on it. But with the Amy thing, we were at Metropolis, and I think that made the strings sound kind of hard and quite 60s, you know. Which he liked, Mark loved, but he chose that studio because they were mixing there and it was going to be convenient. I think Tom was mixing up in Studio E or F, one of those, and we were down in Studio A, which was their biggest studio. And we did the strings, I think, first off. We then did a horn session where we wanted to just have another go at Rehab. I don't know why we did it, because Mark loved how it sounded from the original recording, which was done at Daptone Studios in Brooklyn.
I was going to say, it's the Dap Kings, isn't it? Who did, from Daptones, who did the Sharon Jones, and I love that, those guys. That is just the best modern soul music.
Absolutely, 100%. So we did that, but the brass that we did on Love is a Losing Game, that was a different matter altogether. So Love is a Losing Game didn't have any brass on it, and I had done a very basic sort of chord sort of arrangement for the horns to play. And I think we sort of had two trumpets, two trombones, two saxes of some sort, something like that. And I just asked the players to play really quietly and warm, and the trumpets are low, and with nice vibrato. And so that texture you can hear in Love is a Losing Game is a result of that. Then we did the percussion session. Frank was there playing the timps. And Amy appeared. Someone had told her to go and look at what was in the live room, because it looked really impressive. I've got a photograph of it. I'll try and find it for you. And Frank was actually playing the timps at this point. And I had said to Frank, I'm going to give you the bass line of Back to Black. And he kind of looked at me in a sort of slightly puzzled way and said, what, the whole thing? And I said, yes, yes. And so he kind of starts off, dum, 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 you know, bum, 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 you know, etc. And at some point he stopped, he put his hand up and he said, look, timps don't play all the way through songs like this. So I had to say, look, with all due respect, Frank, we are going to do this, you know, we're going to do this. So he's the nicest guy, and he was really just messing around. I think he was terrified that every timing error would have to be corrected, and it was just going to, you know, take forever. For me, I should have explained to him that, you know, the sound of the timps was really going to be just tucked in low, and it was just almost like the aura of the low end of the timp is what we were going to hear. It was just going to be that. It wasn't going to be the main part of the song by any means. And Amy did come in at this point on her own, and she was wearing a little kind of white dress, like a little wisp of white with massive black hair came in, and she sort of like looked at me with the eye and then sort of sat down at the back of the studio, sort of slinky like, and just stayed listening to the timps for a while. And then, you know, she sort of got up and she nodded to us and went out, and that was it.
Wow.
There's another thing that we did on that track that's quite unique. There's a thing you can do with the vibraphone where you get a double bass bow, which is like a really, really strong bow, and you put the pedal down on the vibraphone, rather like putting the pedal down on a piano, and it sustains the sound. It takes the dampers off the bar. And you draw the bow upwards on the bar, the metal bar, and it produces an incredible sound. It's like a science fiction sound. It's a really beautiful harmonics. And I said to Frank, I'm going to give you the viola part of Love is a Losing Game. And so one of the assistants goes in with the part. And Frank's looking at this. And I said, what could you play on this? And it was literally just like semi-briefs, like a whole bar note for each chord change. There's nothing more complex in the part than that. And I said, what about every other note? And he said, yeah, that's totally doable. And so the track starts, and then he comes in and he draws the first one. And as he draws the bow up, there isn't really any sound, but then he's about halfway up with the bow, and then this aura of sound comes out, like a beautiful orb of colour, you know, appearing. And it blurs into the next chord, and then he starts the next chord, and then that blurs. And when you listen to the track, there's something gluing the horns, these beautiful soft horns, and the strings together. And it's the vibraphone being bowed by Frank.
Wow.
There's something about the song that is wonderful and unexpected and perfect and totally bespoke to her thing, her voice.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think that the arrangement does really contribute there. So when Mark finally played it to her, I think he was basically had his head in his hands and she had her head on the desk of the mixing desk, not looking at anyone. And he was literally just terrified that she was going to hate it, you know, because he really loved it. And the song finished and she apparently just stayed still for about 10, 15 seconds.
Right.
And then she just turned to him quite quickly and said, I love it.
Wow.
It was great. We had the right approach. On Back to Black, we went full orchestral kind of sounding, you know, cinematic. And in fact, the middle part of that, I was hearing something quite, you know, filmic, anthemic.
Yeah. Well, when it breaks down.
Yeah.
When everything cuts out, when she just goes black,
yeah,
black,
that's
that bit.
It, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And
love that.
The movement, the strings just hold there high as she does that, as the breakdown happens. Then they start to move in a particular way that I suppose kind of reminded me of Ennio Morricone kind of thing. However, that links back to Stronger, and middles became my little signature because it's somewhere you can do something different. And often they do break down, so there is an opportunity there. It's not like you're cluttering something up. And if you listen to the middle eight of Stronger, it does a similar thing. So, you know, being an arranger, it's all about not getting in the way of the important stuff. But when the opportunity presents itself to take full advantage of it and create a moment, that's where you can kind of try and shine.
Oh, well, that's absolutely fantastic. Thank you for that. That's you know, it's just so amazing to hear that story. And, you know, that album's, you know, I know we're the Oasis podcast, but, you know, that album is very important to me. And those three songs, and I didn't even know before I contacted you that you had anything to do with it. So, you know, just really, wow, you should be so proud of that work. Well, should we move on to the Liam sort of side of it? But I'm sure there's hundreds of things I can ask you about because there's like Depeche Mode and Uncle and all these other people. But if we let's get the Liam stuff done. So how did the Liam thing come about initially then? How were you first contacted for that?
I got a call from Warner Records A&R department one day and basically said, look, we've got a project. It's quite a big project. You've been mentioned. Are you available to kind of have a chat with Phil Christie at some point? And I said, yeah, you know, this all sounds kind of interesting. So he wouldn't tell me what it was. And then Phil called me and he said, it's Liam. There was a real sort of sense of it being special right from that moment. Like there was a seriousness about it. He said, I want to send you one song, which is the song we're really excited about. And I'd love to know what you think of it and if you're interested in working on it. And that song was Once. And it totally blew me away hearing it. Not only was it...
So what stage was the song in at this point?
The song was basically, as you know, as you hear it now, but without strings.
And send the kids to school. But my friend, when the dawn came up, you felt so inspired to do it again. But it turns out you only get to do it once.
And it was a really nice monitor mix. Everything was clear. It sounded like a mix, to be quite honest. Phil had said, about Andrew Wyatt and their discussions about what the arrangement might do. And the only thing he said to me was, we kind of hear the middle section going a bit psychedelic. That was it. Yeah.
What, the once? Yeah, once. That once. Bit.
That bit. That. Well, I think I just said I loved it and I'd really love to work on it. And
okay.
I'm pretty sure they just sent me another four songs quite quickly. And I agree to my normal process, which is I do a kind of guide arrangement and then present that back to them, the producer or whoever, artist. And then we just bat it to and fro until everyone's happy and everyone knows exactly what they're going to get. And then we get in the studio and do it for real.
Fantastic. And in terms of putting the actual songs together, I mean, like, as we said, I can hear... You know, Gone has definitely got that sort of spaghetti western or James Bond sort of feel to it. That's one that really sticks out. And then, and especially One of Us as well. I think a lot of people, when that came out as a single, there was like a, wow, this is different. And it's almost like a Stone Roses, like Ian Brown solo or Richard Ashcroft solo. Like there's a funkiness to it. And especially the strings really drive that song as well. And so it's, I know when I've spoken to other people who have done string arrangements or harmonica or whatever, these additional things that go on top of these recordings, often they can then be disappointed when they then listen to the final recording and go, oh, you know, you can hardly hear me. Well, I assume that you don't feel that way because you can hear you all the way through all those songs. They are so prominent.
Often it is the situation where, you know, you do wish it was a bit louder. But actually, recently, I've been quite lucky. The reason I got this gig as well, let's talk about that, was because I worked again with Mark Ronson last year, kind of around the summer, maybe July. That's right, the session was in July. And it was for his album, his latest album. And he asked me to do this song he's doing with Miley Cyrus called Nothing Breaks Like a Heart. And
you did that?
Yeah. This was a ridiculous amount of secrecy over this because I think Miley's such a huge star, and she's the kind of star that has a huge fan base, you know, a huge kind of social media. Yeah. So yeah, that's right. I did that, and I was very, very lucky there. And it was Tom Elmhurst again who helped me out here. The chorus part for that, the string players really belted it. You know, we did this at British Grove, which is Mark Knopfler's studio in Chiswick. And this is a studio you can't just really ring up and hire. It's his own personal studio. It's full of incredible stuff, particularly the original Abbey Road EMI desk. We really belted out one of the choruses. Anyway, Tom and Mark kind of came up with the idea of putting that part on its own at the very top of the track, at the front of the song. So it was like an intro. And the strings like had four clear bars playing, you know, really hard and high and sort of strong. And then Miley came in with the chorus kind of tag. And then it was the end of the intro. And then the song started proper. And so on all of the social media, they would use those strings, those kind of naked strings. And of course, you know, everyone was saying, who did those? You know, where did they come from? This world can hurt you. It cuts you deep and leaves a scar. Things fall apart, but nothing breaks like a heart. Nothing breaks like a heart. I heard you on the phone last night. We live and die by pretty lies, you know it. We both know it. These silver bullet cigarettes, this burning house, there's nothing left, it's smoking. We both know it. Mark was working with Andrew Wyatt on something, kind of co-producing or producing the same project. And so obviously Andrew said, I really like those strings. Can you put me in touch with who did them or whatever? And so that's how it came about. I think Andrew must have said to Phil, let's try and get Chris. And so that's why I got that call. And there was a lot of confidence in what I was going to do. And I was really left alone. That really doesn't happen very often. That's right. Definitely a luxury, you know, of getting a bit more respect, I suppose. Because early on, one of the difficult things doing this is that people they want to be involved all the way, and opinions come in and things change. Whereas with this, it was totally hands off. On one of us, Andrew had some very specific ideas. The rhythmic part comes at the end of the song. And one of the really unusual things about the song is, as you said, it has got that kind of poppy, kind of almost sort of Stone Roses type of sort of thing. That rhythmic part that comes at the end where it kind of goes, they're sort of almost like doing a kind of musical Morse code. And then there's another part that comes in at the end, which was my part, I suppose. And it's really groovy. But I just, that's the thing about that song. It's got a beautiful kind of Stone Roses kind of groove.
It's a very interesting song, because then at the end you have that big sort of choral section. It's a shame. And it's just like, wow, where's that come from? You know, it's sort of this extra element that you wouldn't expect at all. So it's a real it's a real interesting song for all those reasons, really.
It is. And you know, I couldn't help but think about all the songs I was working on in a kind of wider context, I suppose. I'd be leveling them against what Oasis did, and I mean, I'm ashamed to say I didn't really know Liam's first solo album, and I didn't listen to any BDI. What happened was, I secretly played the song to my son, Giles, who is 17 at the time. And he'd just finished his GCSEs the year before and went to Reading, like they all do. And he saw Liam headline and performing his, you know, songs from the first album. He was like my little sort of confidant on all of this. And got me listening to, you know, the first album, the best songs from that. And he kind of revealed to me that Liam was his favourite rock star, you know, artist. So that song is kind of revealing. I think this is the genius A&R move, if that's what it was to put Andrew Wyatt in the mix. Because Andrew just brings that LA sunshine, you know. He's a light, airy, you know, unique person. I get the feeling that, like, looking at the whole album, or certainly the five songs that I was involved with, for example, and ones I wasn't involved with, which would be Shockwave, that there is more than a hint of a kind of early 70s prog rock, possibly kind of T-Rex, what could we do to steer it away from out-and-out Oasis? You know, it's interesting looking at what Noel did with his solo work and how he veered quite quickly away from an Oasis sort of sound. And I think that they might have been quite keen to do that with Liam or to find a unique identity. And, you know, maybe that happened through discussions with Liam. And, you know, it's the idea of like, well, maybe we should go back to kind of purer rock. You know, like T-Rex seems to be my reference point. That might not be quite right. But I think if you look at, say, The River and that just simple drone, you know, that is, it just seems to be completely from that era.
Yeah.
I think if you open yourselves up as a producer and a writer to that, to allowing that to come in, then with a kind of prog approach, there's just no barriers to structure, you know. So, yeah, let's have a massive long outro to One of Us. And let's have a choir come in. You know, let's just throw the rule book out completely.
Fantastic. One other specific question. All Right Now, talking about outros, All Right Now has got a very strange outro in that it sort of, Liam kind of sings over the outro and it's sort of this lilting kind of, almost like a lullaby melody, but it then fades out. While he's still sort of singing, it's sort of and the strings are, you know, really lush all over it, and it's just a a really strange kind of thing. It's like, oh, it's fading out. You know, it's a bizarre ending to that one.
You know, that's such an unusual song. It was a real surprise to hear that. It's happiness, that song. Again, real Andrew White type sort of thing. And the ending, yeah, I think it was just a very long ending. And I think it just fizzled out in the Pro Tools session I was given. And so I just wrote the string parts to go right the way through it. And I was surprised, listening to the mix, to hear it sounded to me like they had taken the strings and they had superimposed another part
right.
from a different place over it, because it became slightly discordant.
Sure.
And I really like the ending, but I don't quite know how to place that song. I think I thought it was a sort of like, again, a folk rock kind of early prog rock skippiness to it.
Sure.
And the great thing it does is it just breaks the album up a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, Chris, I just wanted to really pick up on the individual songs, actually. Yeah, it would just be really good to just, you know, individually, they're all so well put together and there's so much going on in them that I think, you know, it would be really lovely to actually just dig into them, if that's all right. Well, you've said you've got some notes there, so which one did you want to start with?
Well, let's start with Once, because that was the first one I heard. So that sort of set the tone for me for the project. You know, and now that's, for me, the flagship of the album. It's just such a great song. Andrew was quite active on this one. He had the ideas for those brilliant pushes in the chorus, the kind of little quaver figures, dagger, da-da, those.
Okay, well, after he says, after you say bag, then, and it goes ba-dum, ba-dum, like that.
Yeah, that's right. And it was great. You know, I hadn't worked with Andrew this closely before. I'd worked with a couple of things with him quite remotely. You know, he was in LA or wherever. And he really had some great ideas for this. And in the end, we kind of negotiated what all those notes should be. You know, it was the rhythmic motif was firmly his, and it was a brilliant idea. Because Liam finishes the line sort of early within each four-bar thing, so there is room there for something to happen. But in terms of what which notes that happened, we kind of decided that between us. Right up until, right when we were in the session, in fact, we kept sort of changing it. but I think the result's really good. And that, you know, that motif, like in a lot of music, you know, if you even go back to like Bach and great composers, you know, they take a seed of an idea, you know, and it could be a rhythmic idea or a melodic fragment, and develop it into something amazing. And I think, you know, we were sort of developing that idea through. So you hear those pushes in different parts of the song. When we went into the middle, where it starts, the strings really start to climb, that was an idea of mine, and it had to be pulled back. Andrew had to firmly pull the reins back, because it was going a bit more extreme than what you hear.
Mm.
You know, although Phil at the label had mentioned, you know, certain things like the psychedelic middle section, and we were doing a kind of tremmy string thing, as well as like portamento or glissando on the strings. It still felt kind of somehow a little Beatle-ish in some respects. Obviously the song doesn't sound anything like a Beatles song, and I'm not implying that. But the approach to the arrangement, I did think, if I was George Martin here, you know, what would I do? So that's Once. I just had an instant reaction to that song. It just clicked in immediately.
Mm. One of the things I was going to say about that middle section is, I think I did feel Beatlesy, and it felt like it doesn't do the same thing as the middle orchestral swell in A Day in the Life, but it feels like a sort of a relative of that, if you know what I mean. It's sort of, because the way, especially the way he's going like once in the background is a bit like the way that, you know, in A Day in the Life, it's sort of counting. And it sort of sort of separates out, and it builds and builds and builds, and then comes back in. So yeah, I don't know if that was a reference.
I think it was just subliminal. I mean, I didn't think about that at all, but it just felt like. In fact, I was amazed that there were, I think, 24 bars of nothing. It just, you know, the band playing, and I was thinking, right, here we go. This is a great opportunity. I'm just looking at the score now. So that middle section comes in, I call it post-chorus, that's post-second chorus, with the climbing violins, and then the cellos and bass, we had a bass as well, a double bass, they're doing little nods to that rhythmic thing, and then the final two bars of that section is the digam, da-dam, digam, da-dam, da. And then we're into the crazy kind of psychedelic middle section with all the tremulandos, glissandos and crescendos.
Yeah.
And then the final eight bar section, the cellos get going with their dun da 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 dun da da dun da 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 dun da da dun da, which is just, I suppose, what has to happen, really, build up.
Yeah.
And then you'll hear the violins climbing through that section. And the last bar, they're holding, and then one, two, dee-da, and they really bash out, the violins really belt out that motif that takes us back into the chorus.
Wow.
Then in the sort of typical fashion, final chorus, the bass goes to its lowest possible note, which is a C.
Wow.
Dee-dum, da-dum, dee-dum. Yeah.
So that's a little trick, is it? That in a final chorus, you'll often go to like the very, very lowest note in the bass?
Well, yeah. I mean, I find it very satisfying, the low end of a string orchestra. So the cellos and the bass are kind of what's called in unison, which you'd expect in a rock and roll song, to be honest. Maybe you also have the violins go to their very highest point in that final chorus.
One of the questions I did put it on Twitter and asked for questions for you, actually, and Ryan Harvey, who is at the Harvey Boys, said, did you see the MTV Unplugged gig, and how did you feel about it?
I was really blown away by it. I was really blown away by the quality of the sound. Yeah, it was really interesting. It was a great thing to see. It was a bit of a surprise because you know, I wasn't in any way involved in that. It was just suddenly, I think the summer came, you know, on holiday, and then all of a sudden, hang on a minute, there's going to be a live MTV of Liam coming up, and you know, I was seeing it on Instagram, and I couldn't wait to see it, and it came out a week after the album release, I think, didn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I watched that as a fan and loved it.
No, that's great. I mean, because it's interesting because obviously you get all your strings in it, but then there are different string arrangements for some of the Oasis songs as well. So, like for instance, Cast No Shadow hasn't got original strings on the album. It's MIDI or whatever. So it's I was like, oh, that's interesting. How are they gonna, you know, what's the arranger gonna do? But I think the arrangements are absolutely fantastic. Whoever did it.
Yeah, I think it must have been the guy who was leading the orchestra or the strings on the night. And I was curious about it. I can only imagine that the touring side, yeah, of Liam's operation would have been more involved in organising that than the record label.
Sure, sure. Cool, good. Yeah, I mean, generally, I just think it's such a beautiful song. And yeah, and your strings do loads to it. And like we were saying when we spoke earlier, they are so high in the mix. You know, this is not like when, you know, I'm sure it must be the case on other things where you think, well, apparently there's strings in there, but I can't really hear them. Oh, no, this is very string heavy. You know, you can really hear it throughout.
I take that as a bit of a compliment. You know, they wouldn't be up if they weren't appreciated or liked. Sometimes, you know, the string part might be developed during the kind of evolvement of the song, maybe even in the songwriting. Or early on in the recording process, and then get completely swamped by new things coming along. So being the last ingredient, I think maybe they just filled some gaps. And the way I would write, I suppose, was, you know, on Once, for example, like where the middle climbs up, it's an opportunity again because it's a new section. Mm. The mistake there would be to do something too busy. And so I just... every two beats, there was a note, you know, in the climb up, and it was harmonized in a way I would sort of harmonize things normally. I try to make things quite anthemic. Mm. And this song was just like a dream come true because it's stately, you know. Mm. It's not like it's just a fast thrash or anything like that. Mm. My favorite song, I suppose, really would have to be Once, but... on the album, but my second favourite is Now That I Found You. That's really grown on me.
Yeah.
And I recently I was sent a couple of, you know, vinyl copies, and we had a little dinner lunch party with some friends, and we were playing the album, and it was interesting listening to it in that context with people, and I thought, ah, this is such a sweet song, and obviously, you know, the sentiment, everyone knows the sentiment behind it. Because there are some big clues in these songs. I think this is quite a, you know, sort of, you know, autobiographical kind of work, the whole album, especially One of Us. I mean, that's one of the ones I did, and I was listening to the lyrics, and I was just thinking, well, this is clearly about Noel.
Yeah.
And he's really cleverly using this, you know, the opportunity. I mean, it made me think about wider things other than just the music.
So go on, where should we go next? Should we go to, well, we're talking about One of Us. I mean, we did talk about that briefly earlier, but one thing I said about it was just so, you know, it feels to me like Richard Ashcroft or Ian Brown solo. I think there's a guy, I looked up, it's Will Malone. I don't know if you've come across
him
before, but I think he's done it. Yeah? So he's done a lot of the work with Richard Ashcroft and things, and it's definitely got that about it. So it's still got that general string sound, but there's much more of a like a funkiness and a rhythmic feel to it.
Yeah. Stone Roses was the first thing I thought of in terms of the groove. I mean, they invented that groove, really. Mm. And probably my favourite arrangement ever that I didn't have anything to do with would be a Will Malone arrangement, Unfinished Sympathy.
Okay.
That was kind of, yeah, as I mentioned before, my kind of entry into the music business was with that, the sort of trip-hop thing.
Mm.
Will Malone's a massive influence, 100%. And I suppose when I was starting out, I probably was trying to sound like him.
Okay.
I did a job for a brilliant Belgian artist, Chris Dane, a few years ago, and we recorded over at ICP Studios in Brussels. But the producer on that had introduced me to Moonlight Mile by The Stones, which is an incredibly interesting song. If you don't know it, I'm sure people do know it. The guy wanted, he called them bendy strings, you know, with a little glissando. And that song it's just such an incredible arrangement, and it's such an incredible song, so atmospheric.
Mm. Bleeding down.
I read somewhere that none of the members of the band were in the studio with each other, you know, when this thing was recorded on, I think, over the period of an American tour or something like that. Rather like maybe the White Album, but for different reasons. Gone is an extraordinary opportunity, you know. The way that starts, like, it means business. I came up with a very strong motif, I thought, which I put at the intro. Those things often get taken out, you know, let's save the strings when they come in, you know, make an impacting moment later in the song, but they kept it in. So the very first thing you hear is like sort of T-Rex and some beautiful strings playing like something that it made me think of a spaghetti western. It made me, I kind of almost imagined kind of Liam on horseback, you know, like the man, like the man with no name, you know,
exactly.
And with a lot of rough beard and a big cap. So, yeah, as soon as I kind of got into that, I was thinking Spaghetti Western, Ennio Morricone, you know, just that, again, anthemic, filmic kind of thing.
But you've got that low guitar, and you do, and things, and it really does.
Exactly.
Yeah. We had a question on that, actually, which was from Benjamin Nibb. Well, more of a comment. The strings on Gone remind me of a Tarantino movie soundtrack for some reason. I love that song. And then the Wheel of Doom came back and said, spot on, was thinking exactly the same thing, would have sounded great in Django or even a movie like From Dusk Till Dawn. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, Tarantino has famously used Morricone's recorded music as needle drop. Although I think Morricone did actually score some of
Hateful
the last film.
He did Hateful Eight. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is. It's not your typical Liam song, is it? It does. I was saying about this. One of the things I really liked about it is it gives... You know, he's a great singer. You know, he's one of the great singers of our time. And he gets a chance to really, like, emote this story song, which, you know, he doesn't normally do that because it's often, you know, the lyrics in Oasis and Liam stuff can often be, you know, like, personal or quite sort of, you know, trite or just made up on the spot kind of thing, it feels like. Whereas this just generally feels like a, you know, like when he says, like, you know, I could give you a chance, you know, I could have given you this life and things like this. It's a real, you know, but you smashed all our plans up and things. It's a real interesting to hear him just deliver this kind of story song, which is so different. And I think, wow, that would be fantastic. You know, I could hear Liam doing Delilah or something like that, you know.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things is that the guitar part. Those little... Dun, 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 those little grace notes. I picked up on those, and I think it was in only at the end the violins play that melody.
Yeah.
Yes. So they take it off the guitar, and it's the whole track is slowing down at that point to the end, and it's like folk music that to me. That's like proper old folk music. Again, a bit of a surprise to hear something so melodic, but maybe that's a bit of a John Squire sort of thing. Why Me, Why Not? This one was co-produced by Adam Noble and Simon Aldred. Adam was at the studio for the session, and I worked with him on this one, sort of remotely. The chugging cellos, we had some horns on this. I think we just heard trumpet, trombone, and tenor sax. And kind of in hindsight, I would have liked to have given it more of a proper orchestral size section. Although, you know, the mix, it comes through, but it could have been a bit bigger, maybe. The chugging cellos, love that.
Yeah.
That was a nice thing to be asked to do.
So all through the verse, it's going dunk, 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 isn't it? Why me? Do, 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 do. Why not? Yeah.
It is, yeah, and the pretty straightforward to do in terms of recording, and we tried a few different things out. Oh, that's right, yeah, that's what I wanted to say. So in the middle section, again, another opportunity to sort of do something to change the tone, really, or to really add something. And where the strings start to climb in kind of like by semitone, and it's, in fact, they're going, you know, in contrary motion, it's called. So the top strings are going up and the lower strings are going down by the same amounts. And it's because that whole section, I think, from memory, was just on one chord. So, you know, if I say it's the obvious reference, but it's a bit Stairway to Heaven in the way that it builds. And I'm pretty sure that I kind of created that. And then I think in the mix there's a Hammond that's doubling it. But it would be a nice surprise maybe for the guys in the studio to have heard my demo of this and thought, oh, that's giving it something.
Added something extra to it. One of the things I felt about that song, and I assume in the writing of this one, I know you weren't involved in the writing, you just got the sort of the demos, but I assume it's a Liam verse and then it's like a Simon Aldred middle eight and chorus. Because the verse feels very Liam, junk, junk on a guitar, you know, and the melody feels like Liam and the lyrics are clearly Liam. But then that big swooping chorus, you know, in falsetto, na 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 na, doesn't feel like Liam to me. And he has said in the past, you know, I have some good ideas, but I struggle with choruses. So that to me feels like a bit of a schizophrenic song in that you've got a Liam bit at the start and then into a big, you know, probably Simon Aldred chorus. And I think the strings feel that, you know, you've got three very definite sections in the song. And I think you can almost tell it almost is, you know, demonstrated by the strings. And there are these three very separate, disparate parts in the song. Does that make sense?
It does completely. Yeah. I mean, I didn't think about it in any way like that. You know, I don't probably know enough about Liam to know that. But basically the verse, yeah, with those, the chugging, the strong chugging kind of rock thing. And then we go into the, what I call a bridge, I suppose.
Yeah.
Is that, ba, do, ba, da, 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 da. And that just felt so firmly like kind of a, in the Kashmir world, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And the strings in this section are kind of like on the snare beat, you know, the two and the four of the beat. One. Yep. Two, three, four, one, da da da, and that sort of da 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 is a semitone thing, but it's trying to work with the guitar, which is just sort of bending. It's presumably being bent up that note, and then he just brings it down in a glissando kind of way. So I think it was written in there that it would be. It's literally written da da da, but I thought the players might just smear it like down like that. But no, they kept it in as the actual notes. So the players adore playing something like this. You know, they all have a rest for the first beat. So it's off, da, da. And so they can retake the bow and start on fresh, they can really dig into it. So that's kind of like nice sort of writing for them. It's lovely when you've gone through it once and the parts are all there and everything's right and you kind of have a feeling it's going to go well. You know, the first run through of a song like this, and then you're in the second take and you're thinking, well, this could very well be the final take, you know, or the one that's used. And as it's going down, the players, you know, they're all different ages, girls, boys, you know, but they're all smiling and loving it. And they know they're going on this track. It's going to be a big track, you know.
So talk me through. So when you're, are you, so this is in Abbey Road, right? And are you,
yes,
and are you physically stood kind of, or the, you know, with the baton, like waving the baton, showing them what to do effectively?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, a lot of people have asked me, oh, you know, do you need to be in the room? Because it's a rock track, you know, it's got a beat. It's got, if it hasn't got a beat, it'll probably have a click track that the players hear to keep themselves in time. So what's the, do you need a conductor? Well, you do. The players love to have somebody to focus on. They're all arranged sitting, so they all look in towards the conductor. Or in this case, this kind of case, you could be called, I could be called the MD, musical director.
Okay.
They follow me for the vibe. I kind of do a lot of gesturing, you know, with my hands, and I don't usually hold a baton. I might hold a pencil or maybe nothing. I feel like it's my job to get them to play hard, you know? And so on that section where it's dum ba dum ba da da da, you know, I'm just making a gesture, so there's no doubt about what's kind of wanted. And I do love the old chugging cellos, and I often turn to the players, and they're usually to my right, and I kind of sort of do a bit of air cello at them, you know, very... to get them, and they usually smile at this moment and think he's doing that again. It's a bit strange, but we think we know what he wants. And I sometimes actually let hold my fist up to them to say, come on,
strong,
give it some, yeah, give it a bit more.
I remember when I spoke to Nick Ingman, and he said, after having worked with the same, you know, he had the same players that he would typically work with, and then after having done Oasis, when he was working with the same players again, he'd say, guys, Oasis, and they get the feel for, like, okay, that's what we're supposed to do here. The power of, you know, how we played that session, just go for it and just really, you know, just go with it.
Yeah, no, I get that. I mean, I probably use very similar players to Nick. In fact, you know, a lot of them are the same. And it's interesting, you know, working with people who are so nonchalant about what they do. You know, they don't just do all the major rock and roll arrangements that need doing. They'll be doing the biggest films. If any films are coming to London to record, which they do from Hollywood, because it's about a third of the price, I think.
Right.
Because of the American unions. Yeah, they will be doing all the quality stuff. And they're just incredible. They read and learn so fast. They've seen and done everything.
You mentioned about the horns in Why Me, Why Not? And there's the, I'm struggling to remember it now exactly, but I think it doesn't end with like a big like ba-bam at the end on the horns.
Well, not quite ba-ba-bum, but the cellos just keep going and they crescendo right the way through to the very end. So jump, 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 like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's
it. I've got a pencil thing here on the brass, the horns, to say that they may have just played the last note, so that the cellos would have played. They had been sustaining throughout those two bars of the very end, and then they just hit an accented note right at the end.
That is fantastic. I think then that takes us to All Right Now.
Yeah, this is an unusual sort of song, I thought. It's great though. It was a bit of a surprise, but I think in terms of the album, it breaks it up a bit and just adds another flavour. And I found the verse, I don't know, I found the verse as it is. I'm not going to say any more. but as soon as it went into the chorus and the pinball lights, I realised, All Right Now, it's just full of happiness.
Yeah.
It's a Liam song that's happy and it's celebrating something. I think maybe there's a lot of Andrew Wyatt in this song.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sunshine, you know, I think it's California in this song. And I know they were recording there. And I go to California, work in LA, and it just, as someone coming from Britain, it makes you feel good, you know.
Mm.
But to be there, it's such a positive place.
Just stay strange and drink away the emptiness. Paranoid, the essayist will end the game by kicking in your door.
Then it completely turns from that verse into this sort of light and kind of fluffy almost. I think Andrew might have come up with that part or had that in mind.
Yeah.
Or something like it. I think he had the dun-ga-dun-ga-dun-ga-dun, and I think I added the other bits around it.
Mm-hmm. And when you were sort of going back and forth like this, would you be sort of speaking to each other and Andrew would literally be saying, how about go dun-ga-dun-ga-dun-ga-dun, like that? Or do you talk in more musician-y terms?
He sang some things while he was in his car, while he was in LA. I could hear he was driving. Another occasion, I think it was this song, I think he might have been on a ski lift. There is a lot of to and froing and just adjustments. And I really love working with producers like that. Mark Ronson's very like that as well. He doesn't sing quite as well.
Well, he can't do everything, can he? Christ, if you sing as well, then we just all should give up.
He can't sing well, actually. He's pretty good.
Fair enough. Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great to hear. I'll tell you what, we'll just cover off a couple of the other questions and points that the guys have made. So Paul Costello said, the strings definitely add a lot to the album overall. Would be interesting to know if Liam contributed ideas to the composition of any of the string parts. or have you heard, my question really is, or have you heard any feedback from Liam as to what he thought of it?
Yeah, well, it was a real, real shame that Liam wasn't able to make the session. He was definitely planning to be there. You know, they'd been recording at Rack in St John's Wood, and you know, Abbey Road is not far from there. But I think something happened on the day that meant he had to be somewhere else. I think it was something to do with his fashion label. The only comment that I had was I was on the phone to Adam Noble, who was co-producing Why Me, Why Not, and Adam was tracking at Rack, so he was really, really involved, obviously, in everything going on. And I was on the phone to him, and he was just basically telling me, he just listened to my kind of demo mock-up of the arrangement, and the strings were really loud in my little mix that I'd put together, mixing, you know, my strings over the whole backing track they'd given me. He just listened to it. He was, you know, really, really happy. And I heard Liam, and he basically said, it's like a fucking James Bond song. and so Adam repeated that for me. And I thought, this is exactly the kind of feedback I like to hear. And it's not the first time either. That's been said.
Good. Fair enough. Khan might say, said, the strings on the album are great, a standout feature of it on my opinion. My question is, does Chris decide whether a song has strings or does someone else decide it and then let Chris compose them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I've never been asked to listen to an album and decide what ones should have strings. That's firmly the producer's role or the A&R team, like I mentioned with the Amy situation.
That you're given, these are the six songs, go for it.
Yeah, or five songs or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it's such a scramble to get everything together. And the A&R team at Warner's are just superb. You know, everything was just booked, done, this is the date.
Right.
And it's just a crescendo up to the moment of the session. And the session happens and that moment when you've finished all the recording and you're just listening back up in the control room, that's joy, pure joy, you know, to get there.
Absolutely.
So, very lucky, honoured person to get to work on something like this.
Oh, that's absolutely brilliant. Wonderful. There's a couple of other comments, but it's just comments and questions, really. So Hub 281997 just said, how does it work that you are so awesome? So that's quite nice.
That's nice. Don't need to answer.
And PP, who is at Blaine's Moustache, said, did you reference What's the Story of Morning Glory at all? And my add-on to that would be, were you actively thinking, you know, about incorporating an Oasis sound or avoiding an Oasis sound? Was that something in your head, or did you just try and not think about that?
It just didn't enter my head. I think there's two things to say on that. Firstly, I just do my sound. You know, it's just the way I write.
Yeah.
The other thing to say is that Wonderwall. So I'm going to show my slight ignorance here. I think that is on What's the Story, isn't it?
Yes.
What happened in that second verse where the cello comes in has become, you know, it's in mythology, in arranging terms. Backbeat, the word is on the street that the fire in your heart is out. I'm sure you've heard it all before, but you never really had a doubt. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now. Really? And many times on second verses, I've brought cellos in. You know, in the old days, it used to be you bring something high and sweet in. Mm-hmm. In the old days, you probably didn't even hear the cellos. I'm talking about the 60s, maybe, until the Beatles started doing stuff. But say throughout the whole pop period of the 70s and 80s, maybe 90s, it would normally be high strings. And so when that solo cello comes in, I put that on the arrangement I talked about before, Stronger, for the Sugar Babes. That's how the strings start. Certainly a lot of arrangements I've done, that's kind of just in an arranger's blood, you know, now. Mm. It's such an incredibly cool thing to do. Mm. So I wouldn't shy away from anything being too Oasis-like. Mm. And I would just do things until I get told not to do them, to be honest. that's what I do. I'm not more important than the producer or the artist, obviously, so that's the way it goes.
So if it came up again, that if they asked you to work on Liam's work, would you come back for album number three?
Without, you know, hesitation, of course I would. Yeah, it's my job, and he's, you know, he's a legend and I'm a fan, so there you go.
Wonderful. So just remind us again, where can people find you online, and especially with your new music as well?
So my website is chriselliottmusic.com, and my artist project I'm doing goes out as Christopher Elliott, and you can find it on Spotify and all the other usual music platforms.
Wonderful. Brilliant. Chris, thank you so much for your time. It's greatly appreciated. And thank you again for the great work on the album. It's absolutely brilliant.
That's a pleasure, James. Thank you.
So I hope you guys enjoyed that. Just to clarify something, this was recorded quite a long time ago now. So hence when he's talking about the EP just coming out that day. This was sort of not long after Liam's album came out back in autumn last year. So it's taken a little while to get to this point, but I'm really pleased to have it out there now. And I hope you guys really enjoyed that. Do make sure you're checking out Chris's music. As I say, it was really good. It's really fantastic stuff. I've been listening to quite a lot of it, and it's great. A couple of bits I was just going to mention before we head off is that coming very soon will be a new music podcast called Shine a Light. Someone said to me today, named after the Rolling Stones song? No, named after the BDI song. And so the idea is guitar stroke indie bands are getting no mainstream attention. If we can bring a bit of attention to them, if we can shine a light via this new podcast, then that would be great. So if you go and follow at Shine a Light Pod on Twitter, the first episode of Shine a Light will be on this Oasis podcast channel, so it will be hitting you whether you like it or not. And then after that, I'll be setting up a new sort of separate channel for it, which will be over there. We'll probably do that once a month or something, just to keep an eye on new music, try and stay involved in new music, try and help promote things. And a few of the names, voices that you've been hearing on the Oasis podcast, I'm sure are going to be involved and helping out with that. And if you want to help out with that, if you're the sort of person that goes to see local bands and local gigs and upcoming bands around the country, then get in touch. It'd be great to hear if you go and see them. you can send me an audio review, we'll drop it in, or if you want to do a phone call interview and we'll put that out, that'd be great. So thank you for listening to the Oasis podcast, and many thanks to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is, and it's greatly appreciated. We've had a couple of new patrons in the last couple of days, which was Dom Hurd and Trevor Duncanson. So thank you very much, guys, for supporting the podcast. Greatly, greatly appreciated. Please remember to review on iTunes and subscribe over there. If you can subscribe on YouTube, that'd be great. And follow on the socials at Oasis Pod on Instagram and Oasis Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. If you want to drop me an email, it is oasispod@gmail.com. As ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.